Chapter 5 Tablets and Tunneling. Even during the 1840s, archaeology was more than just digging for lost civilizations. Layard made brilliant discoveries at Nimrud and Nineveh, but he was working with one hand tied behind his back. He couldn't read the cuneiform inscriptions that accompanied the magnificent carvings on Assyrian palace walls. Who were these powerful monarchs who went to war, besieged cities, and erected human-headed lions in front of their palace gates? The young excavator was aware of the problem, but was no expert in ancient languages. He needed someone who could read the wall inscriptions and tiny writing on the clay tablets that came from his trenches. In his first book, Nineveh and Its Remains, he had assumed that Nimrud was ancient Nineveh. But that was sheer guesswork, and he was about to be proved wrong. Investigation of the Kianjik Mound in Nimrud was very much on his mind, and on that of Henry Rawlinson, a British diplomat in Baghdad. Henry Creswick Rawlinson, 1810-95, was a brilliant horseman, a crack shot, and a skilled linguist. He joined the Indian Army at the age of 17 as an officer in the Bombay Grenadiers. Rawlinson worked hard to learn Hindi, Persian, and other languages. In 1833, he joined a military mission based in the Kurdish town of Kermanshah. He found time to ride out to the great rock of Behistun. King Darius the Great of Persia, 550-486 BC, had commissioned a huge carved relief that covered 111 square meters of smoothed and polished Behistun rock face. A huge Darius stands in triumph over Gaumata, a rival for his throne, in 522 BC, 90 meters above the ground. Three inscriptions in Old Persian, Elamite, a language once spoken in modern southeastern Iran, and Babylonian announce his triumph. Like others before him, Rawlinson realized that this virtually inaccessible inscription on a limestone cliff was the Rosetta Stone of Mesopotamia. The old Persian script, which was alphabetical, had been deciphered in 1802. He scaled the cliff and copied it, but the Babylonian and Elamite texts lay across a deep chasm. Rawlinson threw together makeshift scaffolding and risked his life perched high above the ground to make copies of the Elamite text. Rawlinson's military duties were demanding, leaving him little time for the texts, so his research slowed until he got his diplomatic job in Baghdad in 1843. His new post allowed him to spend time on cuneiform and on making further accurate Behistun copies. He got in touch with others puzzling over cuneiform, notably Edward Hinks, a country priest in Ireland, and Jules Aupert, a French-German linguist. The three of them were the eventual architects of decipherment. The breakthrough came in 1847 when Rawlinson made a third trip to Behistun to copy the inaccessible Babylonian inscription. A young Kurd, nimble as a mountain goat, hung ropes from pegs and clawed his way across the face. Eventually, the boy rigged up a simple cradle seat for himself. He then pressed wet paper into the carved writing. The paper dried into molds that could be used to duplicate the symbols. With the entire inscription, Rawlinson could now use the Persian translation to decipher the Babylonian text. Rawlinson's research now extended to the inscriptions found by Layard at Kianjik and Nineveh. As he pored over the reliefs on the walls of King Sennacherib's palace at Kianjik, he identified the siege and capture of a city. A huge Assyrian army is encamped before the city walls. Soldiers fight their way through the fortifications. Despite ferocious resistance, the city falls. King Sennacherib sits in judgment on the defeated citizens, who become slaves. Rawlinson could read the accompanying inscription. Sennacherib, the mighty king, king of Assyria, sat on the throne, while the booty of Lachish passed before him. This was sensational. The siege of Lachish in 700 BC is described in the Bible's Second Book of Kings. Londoners flocked to view the carvings when they arrived in the British Museum. They are still on display there and are well worth a visit. All these discoveries raised public interest in archaeology to fever pitch at a time when biblical teaching was prominent in schools. Rawlinson encouraged others to dig in southern Mesopotamia, including J.E. Taylor, a diplomat at Basra in the south. Rawlinson sent him to explore possible biblical cities, including some low mounds near the town of An-Nasiriyah, which were often flooded by the nearby Euphrates. Taylor found an inscribed cylinder that enabled Rawlinson to identify the place, which was known locally as Mukwayar, as the biblical city of Ur of the Chaldees, associated in Genesis with Abraham. See chapter 20. Compared with the cities of the north, those in southern Mesopotamia yielded few spectacular finds until excavation methods improved dramatically. The unbaked mud brick was simply too fragile for the diggers to handle. In 1852, the British Museum appointed Hormuzd Rassam, 1826-1910, as director of excavations under Rawlinson's supervision. Rassam was himself an Assyrian with local connections, and he worked hard as Layard's assistant. See Chapter 4. He was ambitious, ruthless, sneaky, and quarrelsome. He desperately wanted to be recognized as a great archaeologist and assumed that wonderful finds were the way to success. When he resumed work at Kianjik, he dug into an area that had been assigned to the French, and so he worked secretly at night. His tunneling revealed a carving of an Assyrian king hunting lions from his chariot. Ultimately, the dig uncovered the whole story of a carefully managed royal lion hunt, complete with cheering spectators and a dying lioness. Like the Lachish siege, you can see the hunt up close in the British Museum. Unfortunately, Rassam's excavations of the palace were so hasty and slapdash that only some drawings of the building survive. These were made by a skilled artist, William Boucher. Rawlinson divided the carvings between France and King Frederick Wilhelm IV of Prussia. The French packed 235 crates for the Louvre in Paris. Their shipment, and that bound for Berlin, were floated downstream on goatskin-supported rafts. South of Baghdad, marauding tribesmen attacked and plundered the rafts, tipping the crates into the Tigris and killing several of the crew. Only two crates of French discoveries at Khorsabad, upstream of Nineveh, ever reached Paris. Fortunately, the lion hunt was shipped separately and arrived safely in London. Henry Rawlinson left Baghdad in 1855. He became active in Indian affairs and was a frequent visitor to the British Museum. The museum had already decided not to sponsor any more Assyrian excavations. So much sculpture had been found that there were almost too many Assyrian kings in London. Public interest faded during the years of the Crimean War, 1853-56, between Britain, France, and Russia. Only a few scholars maintained an interest in the hundreds of tablets shipped from Mesopotamia by Layard, Rassam, and others, or in the collections purchased by dealers from illegal excavations. When Rassam cleared the floor of the Kianjik Lion Chamber, he also found a huge cache of clay tablets. Considering them unimportant, he stacked them hastily in packing cases. How wrong could he have been? 3 years previously, Layard had recovered part of King Assurbanipal's royal library in two small rooms. See Chapter 4. Now, Rassam had found the rest, which had landed on the floor of the great hall when the ceiling collapsed. The king's archive contained records of wars as well as administrative and religious documents. One tablet records how he ordered his officials to collect tablets throughout his kingdom. Over a century and a half later, the 180,000 tablets in Assurbanipal's library are still being deciphered. They have yielded enough information to allow an entire dictionary of ancient Assyrian to be compiled. The focus of Assyrian research passed from the field to the museum and library. A small band of cuneiform scholars sifted through the tablets from King Assurbanipal's library. They worked in a cramped study room without the aid of dictionaries or grammars. One was George Smith, 1840-76, a quiet, shy engraver's apprentice who was passionately interested in cuneiform, having read Rawlinson's work at an early age. By 1872, Smith had already sorted many tablets into categories, one of which was myths. He came across half a tablet and found a reference to a ship on a mountain, and mention of a dove being sent out to find a resting place and being forced to return. Smith realized at once that he had part of the flood story contained in Genesis. The tale is familiar to everyone who has read the Bible. Noah gathered the animals into an ark, survived the rising waters, then sent out a dove and a raven to look for land. Noah and his ark saved humanity from destruction. The normally calm Smith jumped up and rushed around the room in a state of high excitement. On December 3, 1872, George Smith addressed the Biblical Archaeological Society, an organization of the day concerned with excavations to study the scriptures. The Prime Minister, William Gladstone, attended the meeting. Smith's lecture was a triumph. He translated key parts of the narrative that bore a startling resemblance to the biblical story. Smith suspected that they could be traced back to much earlier myths. The story was part of a classic of early Mesopotamian literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh, a king of the city of Uruk in about 2600 BC, long before the Bible, undertakes epic journeys in search of immortality, but fails to find it. The flood tablets seem to prove that the Bible was true. The Daily Telegraph newspaper offered the British Museum 1,000 guineas for a new excavation at Nineveh to find the missing gaps in the story, provided Smith led the investigation. Amazingly, in just a week of excavating at Kianjik at Layard's Dumps, Smith found the crucial missing 17 lines about the beginning of the flood. After only a month of digging, Smith set off home. 4 months later, the British Museum sent him back to try and find more of the Royal Library. Smith recovered more than 3,000 tablets in 3 months, mainly by excavating the contents of rooms where Layard had tunneled around the walls. At times, Smith had 600 men working on the excavations. In 1875, while returning from a third trip, he died of a stomach infection, a great loss to the British Museum. The Kianjik excavations resumed under Hormuzd Rassam. His team cleared the floors of palace rooms and recovered yet more tablets. One 1,300-line inscription on a clay cylinder describes Assurbanipal's conquests. Rassam moved on to Babylon, but, like Layard, his methods were too unsophisticated to find unbaked brick palace walls. He hurried from site to site, ending up at Abu Haba, formerly an ancient city called Sippar, where he excavated around 170 rooms and recovered as many as 70,000 tablets. One of them described how a Babylonian king named Nabonidus became interested in archaeology and dug into the cities of his predecessors. When Rassam departed for England, dealers moved in and caused an unseemly scramble for cuneiform tablets that pitted museum against museum across Europe. The damage was incalculable. Layard, Rassam, and Rawlinson were pioneers, working in remote lands in conditions of tribal unrest. This was rough-and-tumble archaeology, without any careful forward planning, but it was archaeology that validated much of the history set down in the Old Testament and placed ancient cities firmly within recorded history. In those days, when archaeology was in its infancy, many archaeologists were as much opportunists as excavators, and yet some of them were giants in their field. It is on their broad shoulders that succeeding generations of professional archaeologists have stood.